already noticed, but we humans are flawed creatures. We want to be happy. We worry about being happy. We often have the means to make ourselves happier, but we are hardwired to think in ways that make us continually dissatisfied. We fill ourselves with unrest, fierce or merely persistent, even when things, all things considered, could be a lot worse. Of course, it comes naturally to us. Unrest is the default state of all nature, particularly in the spring and early summer. As soon as the ground begins to thaw, nature becomes edgy, and everything begins to wiggle its way into some new state. Rhubarb boils out of the ground in red and green fierceness. Birds claim territories and sing mightily to defend them. Hibernating creatures waken and rush into action to find food and other hibernating creatures. We learned in biology class that restlessness among animals is a response to stimulus. If you watch, for instance, the movement of a flock or a herd, you will see a few in a herd hear noises or catch wisps of scent or find some other little dissatisfaction that makes them stir nervously. The others react to their movement either by getting a little bit nervous themselves or they go back to grazing. If enough become alert and begin to move a little bit, a few more will start and settle, and then more, until suddenly the whole bunch is moving all together. A stimulus can be almost anything. Hunger, fear, discomfort, hormonal urges, etc. And of course, mammals, there's also the factor of youth. Young beings are restless. Humans respond to the same stimuli, and everyone who has observed groups of adolescents has seen flock behavior, hormonal urges, and the pure random restlessness of youth drive our species too. But humans take it farther. We not only get restless and dissatisfied in response to all of the sorts of stimuli that other creatures do, but we also make ourselves restless and unsatisfied by thinking about it. Thinking may be a great strength of our species, but it does have its disadvantages. We want, and because we're conscious of our own wanting, we tend to dwell on our wants, to amplify them, to embroider them, and to create new stimuli out of them. This has pros and cons. On one hand, it gives us the drive to do wonderful things. But if we're not careful, it also makes us deeply miserable. Now, we all have things that we want, and some are attainable and some are not. We want a better job, a different house. We want to be thin and serene and confident. We want other people to do things, to make changes, or to just go away. I want the American public to do some serious critical thinking, and I've devoted most of my life as a teacher to try to help that happen. But it's still pretty unlikely. When I was about 8, I started to want a horse. I believed that if I only had a horse, my life would be perfect and complete. I put a lot of energy into wanting one for my birthday or for Christmas or for any time. I imagined having a horse. I thought of unlikely schemes to get one. Perhaps I could trade in my little sister. I was relentless. And if I got a beautiful doll as a gift, I would be delighted. But my delight was always slightly soured by its unhorseness. When I was 52, I finally got a horse. It's great. I love it. I love having her. I love being with her. But although it makes my life much more interesting, active, and pleasant, it's still not perfect and complete. Now I want different things. I want fewer aches and more energy. And those are not immediately attainable either. Animals generally want basic things. They want food, warmth, companionship, sleep. And once they have those, they're no longer stimulated by those needs and they stop pursuing them. My horse wants licorice quite intensely. She begs for it, and she's willing to do things that seem doubtful and risky to her, like bowing or stepping on noisy pieces of metal in order to get a piece. But once she's had about five, she's had enough, she satisfied her taste for licorice for the moment, and she loses interest. Unlike humans, she has no interest at all in amassing more licorice than will satisfy her sweet tooth for the moment. But humans always want more, or they want something else. If you acquire a beautiful house, you want new furniture. If you get a pretty good job, you want more vacations and promotions. Evidently, if you have a few million dollars, you will feel a desperate and urgent need for a few million more. Doug Horton says, change occurs in direct proportion to dissatisfaction, but dissatisfaction never changes. If we let them, these wants can build into festering desires, and that can make us a great deal more unhappy than we really need to be. But without our natural unrest, we might be more content, but we would accomplish a lot less. Dissatisfaction is what drives us to work hard, to be productive, to think of new and better ways to do things, and to change the world. Dissatisfied people who are determined to do so can change the world in small ways or large ones. But change itself is fearsome and difficult and can be a cause of dissatisfaction. I think humans are the only beings who set out to change the world on purpose. And so far as we can tell, we are also the only animals who anticipate change and fear it before it happens. We want change only when we're ready for it, and only to the degree that we're ready for it. Perhaps someday, but this is not the time, has always been an argument against all sorts of things, including social change. The Jim Crow laws and customs justifiably caused great unrest among blacks, and still do. They struggled heroically, and the laws and customs have fundamentally changed in response to that struggle. They've certainly not changed enough, but we are still struggling with the people who found things just fine as they were and who still fear and resist the changes that have come with the civil rights struggle. On a smaller scale, how many marriages end at the point where one person feels a desperate need to change and the other person is not at a point where they are able to accept and adjust to it? So we're hardwired to be restless and dissatisfied and to spend our energy making things different, but we also fear the change and avoid anything that threatens our security. We're flawed creatures. So how do we cope? Often badly, of course. Too frequently, we allow dissatisfaction to run our lives. If you're simpering about one thing, but not focusing on doing something about it, you may be easily influenced into transferring that simmer to whatever other irritant people around you suggest. The right-wing press here, and the democracy movements in the Middle East are both things that benefit by giving people's unfocused anger and dissatisfaction a specific direction. We overreact and drop everything to make changes, but we throw out the baby or our families or our credibility with the bathwater in the process. We spend time dwelling on unfulfilled wants, but allow our fear of change to keep us from making the steps that we need to attain those changes, causing tension, discouragement, and depression. We focus our unhappiness on problems too large for us to solve. And these ways of thinking make us miserable. Or we might avoid misery by going to great extremes to avoid any influences that might cause discomfort. We can cut ourselves off from the world, absolve ourselves of responsibility, and spend our time in search of comfort, safety, and security. When we do this, we accomplish very little, and we may not live up to our basic obligations to other humans and the world. Eventually, we get bored, and that too makes us miserable. What we need is a balance. We need to find ways to deal actively with our wants and dissatisfactions, but to keep them from ruling our lives and preventing us from being happy. We need to find things to change what can be changed and accept the things that can't. So here are some thoughts. First, when you want, it's important to really seriously think through your want. In old cartoons, you can remember that characters sometimes had little figures on their shoulders. There was a devil on one side that was advising them to do naughty things, and a little angel on the other side that was telling them, that was being their conscience and telling them to behave nicely. And they gave conflicting advice, which was presumably advice that was a step above what the character would have thought of on their own. I like to picture little figures who discuss our wants with us. One asks, "Do you really want that? Why do you want it?" And the other asks, "Is that attainable? What would you have to give up in order to have that?" We know that contentment has more to do with how a person thinks than their situation. It's a cliche that happiness is wanting what you have, not getting what you want. Spending a lot of time focusing your inner dialogue on dissatisfaction rarely gets what you want, and a person with a habit of discontent will find small problems if they lack the large ones. A good way of dealing with this is developing a conscious habit of gratitude. There's a Japanese school of psychotherapy developed by Shoma Morita, which stresses conscious thankfulness. Morita taught people to thank everything, even to comedic extremes. You thank your bed for its comfort and the rice for its sustenance. You thank the sidewalk for holding you up. You thank the sky for being bright blue. And doing this makes you happier. And it probably reduces your overall dissatisfaction. It puts your wants in perspective and allows more energy to focus on selective action. We need to examine what we want and decide what wants are attainable and reasonable. My wanting a horse at age 8 was not reasonable, and if I had really accepted that, I could have saved myself a lot of discontent. Doing that includes carefully thinking through the consequences of attaining what you want. If I get this wonderful new job, will I be happy moving to Seattle and living alone? If you want to dismantle society's safety net in order to have small government, are you really willing to live with beggars in the streets, public starvation, and a dog-eat-dog underculture in order to have that? If what we want is irresponsible or unreasonable, we need to talk ourselves out of it or find a responsible alternative. If something that is responsible, is out of reach right now, we need to look for small steps to help it happen, rather than focusing only on the evidently, the unimmediately attainable end. If it is unattainable, we need to adjust, to look for the parts that our actions can affect, and to stop wasting our energy by fretting about what is impossible. When we do that, we can seethe effectively, and we can use our unrest to selectively and responsibly change the world. Thank you. We have a few moments of silence.